Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Oddly Specific. I'm your host, Meredith Lynch, and I am so excited for today's episode. We have an interview with Senator Elizabeth Warren talking about private equity, and then we welcome friend of the pod, Laura Treader from the American Girl Women podcast, to dive deep on an oddly specific thing about an oddly specific movie. I do want to let you all know that I have some shows coming up. If you are in the Southern California area, I would love to see you. I'll be in Santa Barbara on May 16th with Billy Lee from Vanderpump Rules. I'm so excited. I'm emceeing this show. I'll be at The Crow in Santa Monica on May 25th, and I am going to be performing in the Laugh Riot Girl Festival. It's my first festival. I'm so excited. That is at Tao, and my show is on June 9th. I would love to see you at any of those. I am so excited for you to hear the podcast. Thank you for supporting Oddly Specific. And as always, tell a friend to tell a friend. Let's get into it. Senator Warren, welcome to Oddly Specific, the podcast that covers everything from private equity to Pete Davidson. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. I love talking about private equity.
Same. So I guess that actually brings me right to my first question, which is what motivated you to take a stand against private equity?
Well, think of it this way. Look, if somebody wants to come in and invest in a business and grow that business, triple yoo-hoo for them. I'm happy about that. That is not a problem. What I'm concerned about is the business model that much of private equity is used, where they pay what sounds like some fabulous amount of money, let's just say $100 million to buy this business or this chain of stores or whatever. And then instead of that money going into the business to make the business stronger, to expand it, to clean it up, to freshen it, to do all those things, instead, that money goes only to the investors who had owned the business and the new investors who are going to run it and suck value out of the business. I think of it kind of like an old car. You've got a car, it's running, it's going on down the highway. And what private equity does is it looks at it and says, I think we could make money off the tires and the engine. So they buy it, they pull out the engine and sell it to one group, they take off the tires, sell it to someone else. And then they just leave what's left to rust by the side of the road, but they don't care because they got their money back out of it. And the executives who originally owned that car got their money out of it. And you know who's left behind? Who's left behind are the employees, the retirees, the customers, the communities that counted on that business. They're all gone. And this is just one more example of the guys who understand financialization come in and they figured out how to make the rich richer and leave everybody else sucking air. And that's what I'm fighting here.
Senator Warren, what specific concerns do you have about private equity's involvement in healthcare, especially as exemplified by the situation with Steward Healthcare?
Yeah, boy, that's the right question. Hospitals are super duper important. Important to patients, important to employees, important to communities. Think of it this way. When private equity comes in and hollows out and destroys Toys R Us, I admit I'm still pretty bummed about that. When they do that to Sears, oh no, really? When they do it to Kmart, darn. But when they do it to a chain of 9 hospitals in Massachusetts, where that's the closest hospital for people who have a heart attack, for mama who's trying to get a kid who's gashed her head on the playground and needs to get in and get stitches.
Sure.
All those things where people need access to their hospital immediately. Private equity, when they destroy these hospitals, that has the potential to go away. And there's the special twist. Because when private equity comes in and hollows out a hospital, they know that there's a good chance that the local folks will not let the hospital close. So it will end up costing taxpayers money, because they will have to infuse the cash back into the hospital to keep the hospital up and running. And that's what makes it particularly dangerous when private equity starts diving into the healthcare space.
Yes. And, you know, I have read that the mortality outcomes of private equity backed hospitals are actually lower than publicly owned hospitals.
One of the things we know is, for example, back during COVID, there were nursing homes. Some were private equity owned nursing homes and some were privately owned. Some were for profit, some were not for profit. But when you make that comparison, private equity, non-private equity, the private equity owned nursing homes had a 40% higher mortality rate. Just absorb that for a minute. People literally die because of private equity. And why does that happen? Because private equity cuts staffing, because private equity cuts access to expensive medications, because private equity, as much as this one is going to shock you, I talked to some of the nurses at some of these hospitals that have been taken over from private equity, and they talked about things like linens, whether or not there were enough clean linens to go around in the hospital, whether or not the hospital had continued paying so that it had access to the database that tells you if a patient is taking drug A and drug B and you prescribe drug C, what is the likely interaction? I mean, these are things that directly affect the health and the health care of the people who come to these hospitals. And nobody hangs a giant sign out front that says, warning, private equity has taken over this hospital, so you better understand. They may not have the equipment they need. They don't have the staffing they need. And that's just fundamentally wrong. You know, this is a time when we have to change the underlying laws and say that private equity cannot come in and just hollow out these businesses, suck up all the value for themselves, and leave behind a disaster for the employees, for the patients, for the customers, and for the communities.
Thank you for saying that. I tell people all the time when they say, why do you care so much, Meredith? And I say, at the end of the day, it's truly a safety thing. If it isn't affecting you, it's going to affect your grandmother. It's going to affect your mother. So thank you for even bringing these conversations to light, because they've been living in the dark. And so my next question for you is, you have advocated for legislation that would claw back the compensation from the healthcare executives and Wall Street investors. How exactly would this work, and what outcomes do you hope to achieve with that?
So you'll figure out much of the answer from the name of the bill. End Wall Street Looting is what we've named this thing. And the idea is just to put in place some curbs on private equity. Doesn't say that nobody can ever make any investments in these businesses or in these hospitals. But it says specifically, for example, if you are one of the investors who comes into one of these hospitals and sucks all this value out, and then the hospital implodes, you have to give back the money. And that money can be used to rebuild the hospital. And I want to be clear, and same thing for Toys R Us. If you come in and suck the money out and then the business implodes, then you didn't buy this business to help it. You didn't buy this business to expand it. You didn't buy this business to keep it going. You bought this business to take the value out, sell it for parts, and leave the rusted shell behind. And that is not a business practice that we want to advance. So partly it's about the executives and their own incentives. And by the way, I hope everybody understands right now, now that you and I are talking about private equity, that private equity actually gets special tax breaks that are not available to anybody else. So you start your own small business, good for you, but you pay your taxes straight up. You go in under private equity and suck out that value. Right now, you get special tax breaks. You get taxed at a much lower tax rate. And that means, in effect, all the rest of us are subsidizing private equity, the very entity that is hollowing out our hospitals, for example, and leaving the rest of us to pay to try to keep those hospitals back up and going. So from my point of view, the Stop Wall Street Looting Act is just some common sense restrictions that say you want to invest in a business, good for you, but we're not going to help you hollow them out.
Of course. Yes. Amazing. Well, I guess that brings me to this question that I think about all the time, which is, what can I do? So what advice do you have for, you know, your fellow policymakers? Because I believe this could be a bipartisan issue. I really do. And what, and activists who are concerned about the influence of private equity, what can we do, you know, in our own lives every day?
Well, the first thing you got to do is see it and say something. So it's not enough to wring your hands and say, oh my gosh, these hospitals are closing. Oh my gosh, this nursing home has a high death rate. Oh my gosh, this bad thing is happening. If it's tied to private equity, you got to speak up about it. And when you make the point, and I think you're right on this, that there's the opportunity for bipartisan work. Yeah, right now, Steward Hospitals, for example, we're having a terrible problem in Massachusetts. It's all over the press. We're all talking about, we're talking about at the state level and the federal level. What can we do to change the laws, both to try to protect these hospitals, but to make sure this kind of thing doesn't happen in the future? But you know what? Same kind of thing is happening right now in Texas and in Florida.
Yep.
So I see this as the very best thing you can do is understand what private equity is. Watch for it when you see, and someone you see just a passing reference in an article, oh yeah, and this hospital was bought out 4 years ago by some private equity group. Talk about it. And I get it. When you're on a date, some people may think raising private equity is not just the first thing that you want to do. You might want to wait. It might be your second or third time. But I sincerely mean it. The more that we talk about private equity, that's how we begin to build the momentum to make real change. And if you really want to get wonky, you can say, and take a look at Warren's Stop Wall Street Looting Act and get behind that. But even if you don't go that far, we need people to talk about it, because what's so undermining about this is here are just this tiny handful of the guys who figured out the financialization of everything. Mm-hmm. And they figured out how to look around for these businesses that have a little value, swoop in and make a bucket of money for themselves and have a handful of other investors at the expense of everyone else. And mostly people say, what happened? I literally remember standing in front of the Toys R Us with a grandchild.
Right.
The store had the "sorry, we are permanently closed" sign up, and someone else walked by and said, "What happened?" And right. The assumption was, "Yeah, they just, you know, bad management. Maybe it was bad business models, just didn't work." And the answer is no. It's
private equity,
and we gotta call them out. You gotta name it to change it.
Well, Senator Warren, I think you would agree with what we close this podcast with every time we say, tell a friend to tell a friend about private equity. So I think you would stand by that. And
I totally would stand by that. I love it. Way to go.
And the last thing that I will ask you is, Senator Warren, I am originally from Massachusetts. I grew up in Medford and very proud of that. Went to Regis College. I'm going home this week. Very excited about it. When you're back in Massachusetts, what is like the favorite thing to get for food? Like, what is the thing that you can get there that you can't get anywhere else?
Oh, lots and lots of good Italian food. Not in Medford, but not far from you when you're in Medford. There's a little place called Gran Gusto in Cambridge that we love. They have a pizza that, it's not a pizza place, but they have a few pizzas they make. Pretty fabulous. There's a place called Julia on Mass Ave in Cambridge.
Yes.
Really super duper. And I have to throw in the Shack for lobster rolls. because you sure don't get those down here in the same way. So lots of good to eat. Lots of good eats.
Thank you. Those gave me some good ideas for when I'm home this week. Senator Warren,
I want to get Sullivan's for hot dogs.
Okay. Oh, you gotta. And then you gotta, and then do a lap, right?
Well, of course. Of course.
Senator Warren, I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank your team. They've been a delight. Thank you so much for everything that you are doing in this fight against private equity and everything you have continued to do that is not just for the state of Massachusetts. It's for all of us. So thank you.
Well, and thank you. And thanks for talking about private equity. We talk about it. We can make real change.
Thank you. Have a great rest of your day. Thank you, Senator Warren.
Bye-bye.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Oddly Specific. It is my favorite portion of the show. Well, actually, anytime that I get to talk about private equity is kind of my favorite portion, but also I love this part. This is where we get oddly specific about something that I just can't get enough of. And I'm so excited because my guest today is Laura Treader from the American Girl Women podcast. I've been on this podcast. I'm a huge fan. It explores really just what did American Girl mean to childhoods? How does it continue to come up for people? Laura, what, first of all, welcome to the show, but what made you start the podcast?
Hey, Meredith, I'm so excited to be chatting today. And yeah, you hit the nail on the head. Basically, my podcasting co-hosts, Lindsay, and I started the podcast because during the pandemic, we just discovered that so many of our friends and coworkers and other women in our lives had a connection to American Girl, and they would bring up different things that they had kept with them over the years, whether it was something funny or something heartfelt about maybe how it led to their future career even. So we decided we need to have a conversation about this on a weekly basis.
And you had an American Girl doll as a child?
I had five, I'm ashamed to say.
Whoa, whoa. Five? How many grandmas did you have?
It's so funny because I am trying to remember like how I acquired all of these, and some of it was through grandparents, some of it was through other relatives. I also think I just was so obsessed that I didn't really ask for anything but that for probably a solid 5 years. I was banking an American Girl a year for a while there.
Wow. I remember, and I don't know if I talked about this when I came on your podcast, but I can remember like being at a kid's house and seeing that they had one of the beds, because you know, you could get beds for your American Girl doll. And I just like, I can remember being like, you must have a grandma. You must have a non-estranged grandma, which is something I don't have. So
Right. When you see those big ticket items, you're like, oh, all of their grandparents must be living for sure.
I was at the Century City Mall the other day, which is my favorite mall, and a mall that I have run into you at, which,
yes,
you know, I don't feel like that happens that much in LA. Like,
I know,
adults running into each other at the mall. It's very high school, but I loved it. Yes. But I was at the mall probably in the last 6 months, and there was two young girls walking through the mall, and they really looked like they were on their own, and they were walking towards the food court very confidently. And the food court at the Century City Mall is amazing. And they were walking very quickly, and one of them goes, "It's this way, Grandma," pointing towards the food court. And then I see Grandma, and she's way behind them, and she's got like four massive American Girl doll bags.
Oh my God. The imagery of that is just hilarious. And like, I would imagine that they were with only her, because I feel like a mother or father or parent would have intervened and been like, we're not getting this level of stuff. Like, I know I personally was sort of taking advantage of my grandmother's generosity on a shopping trip. So,
right. So I was like, you know what, girl, you did your thing. You got your stuff from grandma, and now you get to have Chick-fil-A. So,
right. My dream day would be a shopping spree at American Girl that I don't have to pay for, and then following it up with Chick-fil-A for sure.
Oh my God. I know Chick-fil-A is problematic, but those chicken nuggets are really good.
They are good. And you know what? Insert any food court item from Century City. I could easily do Shake Shack as well, but it's just like the perfect end to a day as a youth or an adult after spending copious amounts of somebody else's money.
Well, that's a great segue to our topic, because this topic is set in the Depression. Not a great time for a lot of people in the United States, but some people had copious amounts of money. We're going to get oddly specific about something today, but first we're going to talk about something more broadly, and that is Annie the Musical. So, first and foremost, have you ever seen Annie the Musical? And I will accept the 1982 film version.
Yes, I have seen it on stage, I want to say more than once, and then absolutely the film version as well.
So I did a little poll, little ask the audience before we recorded to ask people what they remembered about Annie, because it's been a minute for a lot of people. Not most people have not had "I'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover" in their Spotify on repeat, except for me. But I asked people, I polled the audience, a little ask the audience, and I said, if you had to sum up the plot of Annie in just a couple sentences, what would you say it is? And you cannot Google it, and you cannot phone a friend. Okay. And people just said some of the basics, which are, a redheaded and a baldy fight Bernadette Peters. Then someone said, it's about how capitalism is bad and yet somehow saves the day. Leader of an orphan gang manipulates drunk lady and war profiteer into adoption. And then perhaps my favorite, I was in my high school production of Annie, and I cannot tell you what it's about. Which I have so many questions because, as someone who I'm going to call you an Annie enthusiast,
Yeah.
given the amount of times that you've seen it. Do you feel like Annie is an interesting choice for a high school play? Because I do.
Well, first of all, the prime age of the main character, very few high school students can pass for this age. And then you have, like, I feel even younger characters played by children. Like, what's Annie's like orphanage pal Molly is
Molly.
like even younger. And I think it's just an odd choice for high school because I feel like there's not that many parts for people to have. Like they're not like a robust enough cast, I feel like, for a high school production.
I completely agree, but I guess you could tie it in with like a less like a history lesson on the Depression.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So like some history teacher takes the class to the matinee production because he's like, this is kind of about the New Deal. I hope you like it.
Right. And now that I think of it, I do feel like it wasn't in high school, certainly, but I definitely watched a version of Annie in school, like on the last day of school when we're not doing any real work. So I do feel like there might be some feasible education tie-in there.
And especially during the 90s.
Right.
So, but Annie itself was based on a comic strip called Little Orphan Annie, which was introduced in August of 1924 about Annie, a young, optimistic orphan with curly red hair, with a plucky attitude and a catchphrase, "Leaping lizards." So, for years, it was a comic strip, but the creator, Harold Gray, actually used the platform to express his own conservative viewpoints. So,
Wait.
yes.
Okay. I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't expecting conservative political alignment.
Well, there's definitely a bootstrap mentality to Annie. Because
Yeah.
if people don't remember, the premise essentially is that there is a young girl living in an orphanage in New York City. She is plucky, she is cute, she can sing. She's got a decent voice. And as a PR move, a wealthy millionaire who goes by the name Warbucks adopts her for a week. Okay? Which is like so messed up if you think about it. Because she's
It's
living
so
in
messed up.
squalor in this orphanage. It's terrible. The woman who runs it has a problem with alcohol. I don't want to take her inventory, but I feel like she could benefit from a meeting. And so she, sends Annie to live off with him for a week. But Annie, you know, kind of takes the whole home by storm. He ends up falling sort of in love with her, I guess, which is like, it sounds weird, but like, I mean, it is weird, but it wasn't that weird, guys. So he wants to adopt her, but Annie's like, I'm sorry, but you can't adopt me because I am the only kid at the orphanage who actually has parents. And Annie has been told that her parents just gave her up because they were not financially well off and that they were going to come back and get her. What she doesn't know is her parents have actually sadly passed in a car accident. And Miss Hannigan, the orphanage owner, CEO, has neglected to tell Annie that. Like, if you think about it, this is fucked up, okay?
I totally forgot that. And this is like just exactly why we have to go back to things from our childhood and revisit them, because I am only just now realizing that it was all a PR scheme for this Jeff Bezos like character to be adopting an orphan for a week to like get some good press. I completely forgot about that, or did not register it at the last viewing that I had because my brain was more youthful. So that blows my mind right out the gate. Like, right? I'm processing this. Yeah.
And so what ends up happening is that Miss Hannigan, the orphanage CEO, and her brother try to kind of scheme to pretend to be Annie's parents and get some reward money that Daddy Warbucks has put out there in order to try to help find Annie's real parents. Well, it turns out through, I don't know, a series of events that at some point involve a cameo from Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Right.
Annie finds out like that her parents unfortunately have passed, but she does get adopted by Daddy Warbucks. And he's like, and we'll also bring some of the orphans with us. And I believe the one of the closing songs is "We'll Have a New Deal for Christmas This Year." So that I think is also sort of based in Roosevelt politics, but it is kind of an interesting story and a little more complex when you are older and you look at it from the perspective of like, if you went into a shelter and were like, I want to take this dog for a week, they'd be like, I'm going to need more paperwork.
Yeah, exactly. Like this, it clearly like absolutely no complexities to the situation here, just able to take a child out like a library book, essentially.
Yeah. And I guess my question to you is, where do you see parallels between, you know, I was a kid, I loved it. Yesterday was plain awful. Okay. And I also loved American Girl doll. So where do you see a parallel? Is it a Venn diagram of kids who liked these?
Yes, for sure. I think in the middle of the Venn diagram, we have a lot of things like storytelling through a child's perspective, particularly through a female child's perspective with historical context, which is not something that we frequently get. I think also in the middle of the Venn diagram is that kind of bootstrap mentality. But I think, you know, sort of on opposite sides, we have like American Girl being like, I mean, I think American Girl's founder, Pleasant Rowland, neglected to identify as a feminist, but it feels like a very feminist story. On the other side with Annie, I feel like, well, I don't know. I think there are aspects of it that could be like potentially feminist. Because doesn't Daddy Warbucks have a female employee who's pretty high up at his company who's working with him?
She is his executive assistant. And like, to her credit, I mean, Miss Hannigan is running the orphanage.
Yeah, like that's what I'm saying. Like, she might be a villain, but like, you know, CEO.
Right. She is a small business owner.
Yeah. So I think that there are definitely, and I think there are also maybe a little bit more of like a harsh, maybe not harsh, but maybe more fantastical lens on the plot of Annie. And it's a little bit more far flung, I think, for the purposes of storytelling. But Annie could easily be a character in an American Girl story, I feel like. And especially because, you know, we have an American Girl character that kind of covers the same time period as Annie, Kit Kittredge, who's a little bit kind of towards the tail end of my time, but I know a bit about her. And they tackle a lot of the same themes that Annie tackles. So, you know, the Great Depression, struggles within like the American political landscape during that time, depending on your age, you might, some of those things might fly over your head, but I think they share a lot of similarities.
Yeah. And I guess like, to me, there's also an overlap with Samantha, because Samantha is not that far off in years. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, even though she is supposed to be, I think, 1904. Okay. I guess not. I guess it's just like, when I think of who, this is Samantha if she didn't have a rich grandmother.
Yes. So you have the orphan aspect of it. And from Samantha's story also, Samantha almost manifests an Annie-like storyline for her friend Nellie, who ends up being orphaned throughout the course of Samantha's stories and is adopted by Samantha's uncle along with her two sisters. So kind of her own Daddy Warbucks, if you will. And Samantha is also eventually adopted by her uncle as well. So you kind of have Samantha's very privileged orphan story running parallel with Nellie, her friend and former house servant's more Annie-like story. So I do think that there are some commonalities there as well.
Yeah, I do agree with you, though. I think people who are attracted to the American Girl story are probably attracted to the musical Annie. Because I also think there's a scrappiness to Annie of like, and I don't know if you did this when you were a kid, but like, I could make it on my own out there. And I used to think that all the time.
Yes, 100%. I mean, I think that like goes back to, you know, the point of view that we're getting is from a like child's point of view. And there's nothing, we don't ever, I think, question Annie's ability to like make her own adult decisions in the same way that like a lot of the American Girl characters are just like making these like insane choices and having these insane adventures for kids their age, but they're not always like so crazy. And I feel like we put a lot of like faith in these characters too, which then I think in turn as like the viewer or reader in American Girl's case gives us as young girls and maybe adults even revisiting a lot of self-confidence. So I think like as a child, a takeaway from Annie and American Girl is kind of like, well, girls can do anything despite the fact that they're number one girls and number two children.
What is the most unhinged thing that you feel an American Girl doll did?
I believe that Kirsten burned down her family's log cabin. Not on purpose, but I believe that happened. I know that, you know, Felicity stole a horse from an older Scottish alcoholic gentleman who...
who honestly, born in the wrong time period, because him and Miss Hannigan probably really would have hit it off.
Right, exactly. And then, you know, you do have Samantha who, you know, essentially liberated Nellie and her sisters from an orphanage. So those would be probably some of my top three unhinged moments.
Yeah. And I mean, like she is hiding them in her aunt and uncle's attic for like a week or so, which is pretty fucking wild. And
two of them are deathly ill.
You'll be fine up here.
Yeah.
The reason, though, that I really wanted to talk about this is because there's something oddly specific about Annie. There are many oddly specific things about Annie, I would say. And I think we've uncovered a few of them, but there is something oddly specific about it that I want to talk to you about. And it's about a TV show that was kind of a Dateline spinoff. It was called Turning Point, and it would be hosted by people like Barbara Walters. And in 1997, there was an episode of Turning Point. It was an hour-long episode, and it was almost shot documentary style. And in it, it was the story of the search for the next Annie. It was the 20th anniversary of the musical, the 1977 musical first coming out, and they wanted to recast Annie using, in a sense, virtually unknowns. So they had this, they teamed up with Macy's and they did this huge like search for a star, and you could go and audition to be an Annie. Any young girl could go. And so I think to me, this was so interesting because it was so, this is pre-American Idol, remember? So this idea that like anyone could be a star, I think was so embedded in the 90s. Now yes. It's like you have to have been on a Disney show or you have to have been born into this family or whatever. But in the 90s, it felt like I could be at Macy's and next thing you know, I'm on the Great White Way. So first, my question to you is, did you know about the show? And then my second question is, as a little Laura growing up in Massachusetts, much like me, would you have wanted to audition?
I did not know about this show at the time, but I have encountered mentions of it since then. And I agree with you that it does sort of capture an early, like even like reality TV competition essence, like of just really being like true anybody's coming onto our screens. And then secondly, I 100% would have wanted to audition for something like this. I definitely would have perhaps felt intimidated by the fact that I did not look like Annie, but you know, as we know, movie magic does not necessitate that, but I definitely would have looked at that as like a barrier to entry for me. But what a dream.
Oh my God, I know. And can you imagine like going to Macy's with your like parents and then next thing you know, you're like on TV and then the next thing you know, you're like making it throughout these auditions. It's such an, it's just the idea of it, I think to a 9-10 year old would be so exciting. And the show itself covers the basically months long process that this is because they have a huge casting call and then they narrow it down and then they fly some of these young women out to New York City and they have more intense auditions, etc. They have to get to know the dog, which by the way, Sandy, there is a guy who breeds Sandys now, but I'll have you know, as a fellow dog mom, a fellow dog rescue mom, the first Sandy was from the pound. They just went to the pound and picked out a dog and adopted it.
Ugh, and as also they should.
Too, like that to me is a little concerning that they were just like, yeah, we'll take that one. And it's going to be in a musical. Like, it's just like the, it's just like the same as Annie, the music, like, oh, we're yes. just going to take that kid for a week.
It's actually, you're so right. I'm like, yeah, they should not breed Sandys, but you're right. For the first one, that must have been kind of traumatic because he/she was not a paid actor by trade, not in the union for pet actors. And it's exactly like, it's like a perfect metaphor for the Annie plotline.
Right? So they audition all these young girls, and some of them have a lot of acting experience. Some of them are completely new to acting and singing, but there is this one young girl, and her name is Joanna Pasiti, and she ends up winning the quote unquote competition. She is cast as Annie. And I remember seeing this girl and watching this episode of Turning Point and feeling so connected because she was like from Anytown, USA. Her dad ran the barber shop. The family lived above it. And she would just be like, I just go downstairs and I sing. And it just felt like, oh my God, this could be me. This could be my friend. And I think there was something really heartwarming about it to see a kid literally come from what was, I mean, she was a good singer and she'd been in some like regional productions, but to like come up and now all of a sudden she's going to be on Broadway. So it was very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that, you know, when kids think they see themselves reflected, and we talk about this now because like there's plenty of people who look like me who are reflected in stories for kids, right? But it is so important for kids to see people that like remind them of themselves.
100%. Absolutely.
Do you have like a character that like you or something like that where you were like, this reminds me of me or my family? Like I remember watching Malcolm in the Middle for the first time. And being like, oh my God, this is a family that looks like my family. Like my family didn't look like Full House. We didn't live in like some gorgeous home. And I was like, this is a real family. The parents are both going to work. The mom's annoyed. Like, I love this. Was there something that felt like you?
I'm trying to think. I grew up watching so many old, like Nick at Night sitcoms, like the Jeffersons, All in the Family, those types of things, where admittedly, like I did not always see like elements of my family reflected there, but I loved watching like different representations of like the quote unquote American family. I can't think of anything as a kid that I really just absolutely resonated with in terms of like my family dynamic, but I do remember once I got to high school watching the Mary Tyler Moore Show with my mom and being like, oh, this is what I want to be, like a single gal. And I could easily see that like pathway laying out in front of me, like single career girl living in your own apartment. So in a way, I did see myself reflected aspirationally there, and also saw myself reflected in Rhoda, because, you know, Mary's kind of like the perfect one and Rhoda's like the more real, like maybe where the audience can identify. So for me, that was probably one of my like biggest entry points to like my becoming an adult woman self.
Yeah. And I think like, you know, at the time, not when you were watching it, and as a fellow Nick at Night kid, if you know, you know, it was really ahead of its time for the time that it came out in. So to see like different stories reflected, like a woman hadn't really been the central character of a TV show, especially a single woman who was childless, who, you know, anyway, I think that's so interesting. And I think, you know, for me, when I saw this little girl, Joanna, I thought, oh, I could be a star.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think like, you know, depending on other kids, it's almost like you could see something on TV and you could also see just like hear gossip at school. It's like so-and-so like gets to do this thing or whatever. And, you know, it would make me want to go home to my mom and be like, mom, like, why can't I take horseback riding lessons? Like, you know, and so to me, this search for Annie would have almost been like an extension of like the school happenings of like, what are the other little kids getting to do that,
1,000%.
You know, my mom doesn't have time to take me to auditions.
Like, you have 5 American Girl dolls. Okay.
Right. Exactly.
That was your Annie. So right. I guess, you know, what I have always found though, so oddly specific about this is that the revival opens and Joanna Pacitti is, you know, doing all the shows that are leading up to the Broadway debut of this, you know, anniversary revival of Annie. And I actually saw it in Boston, and Nell Carter was Miss Hannigan. And it was, I mean, I was a kid, but I remember thinking it was a great show. And I remember being so excited because, you know, I'd seen the episode of Turning Point. And so I felt like I knew it. And a lot of the other young girls who had auditioned for Annie had then been cast as orphans. And so Joanna Pacitti is doing the show. It's getting lukewarm reviews. Which, like, it's fucking Annie, okay?
Like, yeah, we're relying on, like, a cast that's, like, 60% children.
Right? Like, get the fuck over yourselves. And according to the story, Joanna Pacitti gets bronchitis in Boston, which in February, I believe this was in February. I could be making this up, but in the time of year of that happening, like you're going to get sick in Boston in,
right?
Like if you're a kid, right? Like you and exactly. I grew up there. We know. So you get sick. So she gets bronchitis and they have to put the understudy Brittany Kissinger in, and Brittany performs, and the producers decide that they are going to replace Joanna with Brittany, and they knock on Joanna's door at midnight and wake up her and her parents and tell them, we really like Brittany. We think that she's the better fit overall for the show. So we are going to replace Joanna. And they try to work out something where it could be like a co-lead, like maybe some nights it's Joanna and then some nights it's Brittany, but they're not able to come to the terms. And so Joanna is essentially fired right before the Broadway debut from being Annie and kicked out of the show. And I've always just found this to be so fascinating. In many ways, heartbreaking. I mean, obviously someone will say there are way worse things in the world. No, there aren't.
Actually, this is the worst thing in the world. This is the worst thing to ever happen.
Can you imagine being like 9 years old and you get cast in a Broadway production of Annie and you're on a show with Barbara Walters, and then they knock on your door one night and they're like, sorry, but we're actually going to replace you with the understudy because we just realized when you were sick, she was better.
It's the public humiliation of it, because the search was so public. And then, you know, I'm sure there were many different other media outlets covering the search besides the program that actually aired it. That must have been so hard. The only way that I can relate is that when I was in the third grade, so about the same age, I was the student council rep for my class. And then there was an alternate. So it was like whoever got the most votes was the rep, that was me. And then the second most votes was the alternate. And I was just like really bad at going to the meetings because I was 9. And so my teacher said to me that, and they were before school, and my parents were like, we have 2 kids. We can't get you there. We can't get you there. Sorry. The teacher was like, we're thinking of letting Celia be the rep and having you be the alternate because she's able to make the meetings.
Oh my God.
I know. And that felt awful as an elementary school kid. And that wasn't even very public. So I can only imagine how this poor girl felt with this like public humiliation of, you know, basically having the audacity to get sick and then be replaced.
Well, like, don't you also think, and I mean, like, I'm in a different stage in my life now, but like, there would be things that would happen, like at school with friendships, with whatever. And you'd be like, oh my God, like if I have to miss that thing, the whole friend dynamic is going to change. Or like, maybe you like this boy and, you know, everybody's going to go to this party and you're sick and you're like, if he's there, like maybe like some other girl will talk to him and he'll like her, whatever. Yeah. That's like what happened to Joanna. It was like, oh, okay, I'll be the understudy.
Right. It's almost like fear of missing out, and except the fears are realized. It's not, it's you're like, what am I going to miss? And it's like everything. You missed everything.
So her family tried to kind of push back and do a lawsuit because Macy's was also part of this, but that didn't really end up working out. And, you know, Joanna, it seems like has, you know, continued to go on and do some music and things like that. But I do think, you know, anytime that anyone loses a job, especially like, imagine if you just found out like one day, like they were like, you know what, someone's just a little bit better at your full-time job, Laura, than you are. So we're going to like, that's terrifying.
Awful, especially because it doesn't sound like she was even bad. She was just not as good, which, you know, it's like, it's all about comparison, right? Like compared to the understudy. But if the understudy didn't exist, like, would she be fine? Like, I don't know.
And like, also too, then you also remember these are all like 9-year-olds.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm like, did anybody give her direct feedback and maybe try to do some coaching?
Well, I will say this. They did let her keep the Sandy that she had been working with.
Which hopefully was something her parents wanted and not like a disaster.
Can you imagine like, okay, so we are going to have to let you go. They bang on the hotel room door, but hey, guess what? The dog you can keep. Like if I were her parents, I'd be like, are you fucking kidding me?
Right. It's like, great. Now we have an unemployed 9-year-old and a new pet that we have to take care of.
Right. So I've always found this story to just be so, as I say, oddly specific. And also I think so indicative of the 90s, because the reality of the 90s was, yes, it felt like anyone can be a star. Anyone could show up and pull themselves up by their bootstraps. But at the end of the day, like the crushing weight of a male director would still ruin it all for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. The bootstrap theme going through this entire storyline parallel to Annie is just hilarious also. And yeah, it's like anybody can be a star, but also just the nightmare scenario of like the worst case possibly happening, which is that it's just ripped away from you. Like I'm sure any of the girls who are auditioning for this were never imagining a scenario in which they would win and then it would be taken away a few months later.
I mean, if you think about it, though, it's such a Boston mentality. Like, don't get too happy being Annie. They might replace you. They could replace you. Like, that is like textbook Boston. And it did happen to her in Boston. So I also feel a little guilty.
Yes. Boston was a little bit too real for the magic of this story.
Right. Well, Laura, I want to thank you so much for hanging out and getting oddly specific with me about a 1997 48-minute special that, you know, a therapist would argue I should have moved on from, but I would say different. So thank you for being with me, and tell America where they can find you.
Thank you so much, Meredith. I'm about to go pop on Annie right after this and see what else I may have missed in my youth. But yeah, I have a podcast called American Girl Women that I co-host with my friend Lindsay. And you can get it just by searching American Girl Women on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We also have a really fun nostalgia Instagram called just at American Girl Women, where we're posting clips from the American Girl catalog, the American Girl magazine. We're also posting, you know, clips of interviews that we've done on the podcast as well. So you can follow us there.
I love their American Girl Women Instagram page, you guys. If you want to talk about oddly specific, let's talk about the fact that they will do like turning of the pages in the American Girl magazine, which like, I know what you're thinking. You're like, Meredith, I don't need that. And it's like, actually you do, because the advice that these girls were giving other girls about like bullying, we still need it. Like there is such good advice in the American Girl magazine.
Absolutely. And I promise you, if you think that you remember things about this and that there's nothing for you to uncover, you're absolutely mistaken, because I have lived in this world for like 3 years now, and I'm discovering new things that I forgot about from American Girl every single day. So get in there, see what you can find.
Thank you, Laura.
Thanks, Meredith.
Well, sadly for private equity, another episode of Oddly Specific is officially in the books. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Senator Elizabeth Warren and my conversation with Laura Treader, who, by the way, kind of brought it for the Annie conversation. Can we agree? It is so fun doing this podcast. It is truly a dream come true for me, and I could not do it without your support. I want to get my little shout outs in here to all of the Patreon pals. These are folks who support the Patreon and give at a level that helps sustain the podcast, and I'm grateful for them. Allison Tyler, Annie Schreiber, Caitlin Duffy, Corinne, Debbie Perillo, Aaron Johnson, Jess, Casey Andrews, Kristen Zanotti, Lady Swamp, which gives no fucks, Macy Malachek, Megan Jacobson, Tom's Law Firm, it's about Tom, Virginia White, and San Fran Gal. If you would want to support at the Patreon level, feel free to check it out. It's on my new website, MeredithLynch.com. I think the old Meredith Lynch gave up the domain name. I probably have wreaked enough havoc on her life. Wrecked, maybe one in the same. Anyway, thank you so much for hanging out. I've got a fantastic episode that's going to be out next week. I am grateful for your support. Subscribe, rate, tell a friend to tell a friend about private equity.